You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. I want to tell you about a new podcast called Outside the Box. If you're a maker, a doer, an innovator, or even just a consumer who wants to get a peek behind the curtain of some of the world's greatest organizations, you should check it out. The first episode features conversations with presidents and CEOs from organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, Feeding America, and more. And you can expect new episodes about things like corporate culture in the 21st century and inventive approaches to business with great insight from some of the brightest minds in the nation. Listen and subscribe to Outside the Box in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy the show.
Judge Thomas, are you aware of that division of our government known as the Criminal Justice Department?
Of course I am, Senator.
Well, you know when you walk in the main entrance of the Criminal Justice Building, there's this receptionist with short brown hair?
The one at the third desk on the left?
No. The one at the big circular desk right there in the center there.
Oh, yes, Sandy.
Yeah, Sandy. Do you think she'd go out with me?
And if there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
That was Al Franken playing Senator Paul Simon in a 1991 Saturday Night Live spoof of the Clarence Thomas hearing, followed by a more recent clip of the now real Senator Al Franken catching Jeff Sessions in a blatant lie about his involvement with the Russians during his hearing for Attorney General earlier this year. Al Franken's journey from satirist to senator has certainly been a remarkable one. Going into comedy with his childhood friend Tom Davis, Franken got hired as a writer and performer on the first season of Saturday Night Live in 1975. During his 15 years at SNL, he wrote numerous sketches and created various characters, like his self-help guru Stuart Smalley. He made memorable appearances in films like Trading Places and Stuart Saves His Family. He also wrote for films like When a Man Loves a Woman and TV shows like Politically Incorrect, before writing number one New York Times bestsellers Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, and The Truth, in parentheses, with jokes. For 3 years, he hosted the Al Franken talk show on the newly formed progressive radio network Air America before deciding to run for the Senate seat once held by his friend, the late Paul Wellstone. After the closest Senate election in U.S. history, followed by an 8-month legal battle, Al Franken was finally seated in the Senate on July 7, 2009. Immediately rolling up his sleeves and getting to work, Senator Franken wrote and passed his first piece of legislation, the Service Dogs for Veterans Act, just weeks after taking office. As a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Franken presided over the confirmation votes of Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. A member of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, he was one of the strongest advocates for the Affordable Care Act and played a key role in reforming No Child Left Behind. Franken also serves on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee and the Indian Affairs Committee, and he's been a leader on issues like financial reform, Native American rights, women's rights, mental health, and addiction. In 2014, the people of Minnesota re-elected him to the Senate by a 10-point margin, and now he says he can finally afford to crack a joke now and then. He does so with his signature mix of political satire and serious policy in his new number one bestseller, Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Today, he joins me to talk about his evolution from comedian to U.S. Senator, how he learned to keep his comedic instincts in check and listen to his staff, and some of the things he's wanted to say, but didn't until now. He talks about working on the first season of Saturday Night Live, his memories of cast members like Chris Farley and John Belushi, and why he says Lorne Michaels was right not to make him the anchor of Weekend Update. He recalls his first Senate campaign, how Republicans put his past jokes through what he calls the dehumorizer, and how he gradually won over Harry Reid, Chuck Schumer, and the Democratic establishment. He discusses his confrontational exchange with Jeff Sessions during his Senate hearing for AG, doing comedy routines with his Republican colleague, Senator Pat Roberts, and why he says Ted Cruz is a toxic coworker. Plus, Al Franken shows how he sings for his supper with the fundraising song. Coming up with Senator Al Franken in just a moment. Today I'm sitting down with Senator Al Franken of Minnesota, formerly of Saturday Night Live for 15 years, film and television, and number one best-selling author of 7 books, including his latest called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Senator Giant, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, you call me Senator Franken.
Okay. Oh, okay. Mr. Giant?
Just Al.
Okay.
Be fine.
I'm not that comfortable. I'll call you Senator.
Senator Franken. Senator is good.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. You know, it sort of takes the opposite of the typical political bio where a candidate has all of his humanity focus grouped out of him and then suddenly hits his stride when he learns to just be himself and trust his instincts. You're the opposite. So much of this book is about you learning to ignore your instincts and trust your political consultants.
Yeah, I had to, you know, it was unusual for someone to run for the Senate as their first office. And you know, there's two schools of kind of people who run for higher office the first time they run later in life who've come from another career. And it usually is, there's the one school is, I was successful in my first career for a reason. I know what I'm doing. I'm smarter than everybody else. I trust my gut and... I'm going to ignore everybody else. And that works for, that doesn't usually work unless, I guess it works for
the president, apparently.
If you get a little help from the Russians, it does, yeah. And then there's the other way it's been successful, which is I know what I don't know. I'm smart about that. I know what I don't know. And I'm going to ask people who have done this before, take advice from them. I'll ignore some of it, but I'll I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
And so I did get some really good professionals who'd worked on Paul Wellstone's campaigns and I felt in very good hands.
You made it through your first term now. You made it through the re-election in 2014. Does this book in some ways represent, I guess, you letting your hair down a little bit and, God forbid, allowing yourself to be funny again?
Well, actually, I kind of allowed myself to do that after re-election. I won the first election by 312 votes, as you may remember, and was a
long process. There's a recount, then a legal process, and it all lasted about 8 months. And when I got in, I wanted to communicate to the people of Minnesota after this nasty campaign that had focused so much on, you know, they had put everything I'd ever done in comedy through this machine called the Dehumorizer, and it... You know, it had very sophisticated Israeli technology that took all the irony out of anything or hyperbole or and the context of things. So I wanted to show people of Minnesota I was serious and that I was going to be a workhorse and I was going to work for the people of Minnesota. And I did that. I did that pretty successfully, I think. And I was very comfortably reelected. And so after that, I said, okay, I think everybody got it. Everybody gets it now. And I'll continue to be a workhorse, but I'll now have a be a workhorse with a sense of humor.
That whole first election, every joke you ever made, everything you'd ever written was scrutinized. And it seems like you had to constantly be explaining irony to people over and over again that
whole
election.
Well, I didn't, actually. You know, at a certain point, I learned you can't litigate comedy. And if you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah.
And so at a certain point, I just had to go, look, I'm not going to go into explaining every joke, but being a senator is different than being a comedian, and I know what the difference is, and this is what I want to do as a senator. I gave up the ghost on litigating my career, and that was painful. I've been very proud of my – it was really over a 40-year career because I started in high school, so I didn't know when to – say I started, but it had been my life's work, and I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, well, there's no shame in being funny. You know, I have to wonder if you ever wanted to say to these people who are constantly playing gotcha with you, you know you're being an a-hole here, you know you're feigning ignorance and shock,
but
well, you know what a joke is, right?
Right, of course. There is that deliberate, you know, unwillingness to understand what the joke is. And not only, I mean, you say there's no shame in being funny. I was very proud of what I had done with my career. I was very proud of the books I had written. I was very proud of the work I'd done on SNL. It was more than just no shame in it. I was really proud of it. And I was proud of how I had used my humor. And sometimes I wrote just really stupid stuff. You know, Belushi is Elizabeth Taylor choking on a chicken bone. I mean, that's dumb. And giving herself the Heimlich maneuver. I mean, that's just dumb. And sometimes we wrote very sophisticated political stuff that I talk about. Did that with a lot of people on the show. Jim Downey, who was a very thoughtful, smart conservative. He and I wrote a lot of stuff together. And I felt that I talk about that in the show. I talk about the SNL years and what it, but it was more than just I was extremely proud of my career. And well, yeah. So it was like very difficult to go like, okay, I'm not going to explain it anymore. I'll just go with what I want to do in the Senate, and I don't have to defend anything.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about that pre-Senate career. You were on Saturday Night Live for, I think, 15 years from the very first season. What was it like as they were trying to figure out just what this thing was going to be? It must have been totally chaotic but exciting, I imagine, on that first season.
It was. I mean, if you look at the first show, it's very different than what the show became, and it evolved very quickly. But it was funny. I write in the book that I was kept telling Tom, we got the job to be – we were –
Tom Davis,
the
original,
Tom Davis,
partner,
Tom
right?
Davis, Frank and
childhood
Davis.
Friend.
Yes, we went to high school together and started doing comedy in high school. Did this review theater in Minnesota. But I was telling him, like, after we were there a few weeks and we had the cast was forming and Belushi came in. Aykroyd and Gilda and maybe Lorraine were the first hired as cast members, and then Garrett and Chevy. Chevy was a writer. I think Garrett was a writer too, originally hired as a writer. And then Belushi did his audition as a samurai. And we had writers like Mike O'Donohue, who had been one of the creators of National Lampoon and was very highly regarded for his very dark humor.
Yeah.
And I remember telling Tom, I like, we're, this is going to be a hit. Now, I was 24, Tom was 23. We had never worked on anything on a show before. There's no reason ever to believe anything's going to be a hit.
Yeah.
But I said, look, this, you know, and we had an agent who saw us in L.A., here in Hollywood, at the Comedy Store, asked us to write stuff because he liked our writing. And we sent a package in. But we sent a package to a show that didn't exist, for a show that didn't exist. We actually submitted a newscast, a commercial parody, a sketch and a film, and it was like 15 pages long. It was 14 pages submission, but it was very much what the show would become. And I just told Tom, this is going to be a hit, and it's just stupid for anybody to be that arrogant at that age. And but it was.
And, you know, and I always ask SNL alums about Lorne Michaels because I feel like he's a little bit like Kaiser Sosa, you know? Everyone gives you a different version of the guy.
Yeah,
but, you know, some say he's this fatherly mentor. Some portray him as some kind of cruel Machiavellian guy throwing artists into the gladiator pit to duke it out.
Yeah,
you knew him from the very start, the young Lorne Michaels. What was your impression of him?
Well, Lorne had been part of a team in Canada.
Right, like you guys.
Yeah, the Hart and Lorne. Show. They had a show on the CBC. And then I think Hart Pomerantz decided, I think I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm not going to do this comedy thing. And so Lorne suddenly goes off to LA and does Laugh-In and produces Lily Tomlin specials and has our show. But because Tom and I were a team, I think he was kind of looking out for us. So we felt a very sort of, you know, paternal feeling coming from him. And, you know, I think that the show has such a, so much pressure, SNL, the show, we called it the show, obviously. And so your experience of Lorne is usually colored by your experience on the show. Mm-hmm. And I had ups and downs, and I left the show finally. I was there the first five seasons, and I left, and
you
then
left
came
with
back.
With Lorne, right?
With Lorne, yeah. And then came back in 1985. I was a Lorne again writer, and Tom and I were back, and stayed for another 10 years. And then I left because I wanted to do Weekend Update, and I didn't get it. And I said, okay, you got to, you know, Lorne had created a very safe place to work for, and there are always frustrations on the show. But I felt like there's nothing better than writing something on a Tuesday night or Wednesday morning and getting out and having a kill on a Saturday. So
yeah.
There's just kind of nothing like that. But I felt like it was time for me to leave. And I thought actually Lorne and Don Olmeyer, who was the head of NBC at the time, made the right decision going with Norm Macdonald. As I write about this in the book, and I had basically shown my that I was a liberal, that I was a progressive in stuff I had done outside the show. Stuff on the show that we did, we felt it was not the job of the show to have a political bias. And whereas maybe most of the writers and performers on the show had your, you know, kind of standard Hollywood liberal bias or New York Hollywood liberal bias. Yeah. It was not the job of the show. Jim Downey, again, I bring him up because he probably had more to do with the political satire and the history of the show than anybody.
Right. He was a Republican, right?
He's a conservative. Right? I'm not sure he's a Republican, but he's conservative, but very thoughtful. And we just felt that the job of the show was to do well-observed, smart, you know, comedy, satire, that, you know, didn't punish you for not knowing stuff, but reward you for knowing things.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Senator Al Franken when we return in just a minute. Hey, guys, do you hate shopping for clothes?
Well, now there's an easier way to get better clothes, Bombfell. Bombfell is an online personal styling service that helps men find the right clothes for them. And unlike other services, there are no fees to work with them, so it costs nothing to sign up. It's simple and straightforward. All you have to do is complete a questionnaire, and a dedicated personal stylist will handpick pieces specially for you. Then, once you've viewed your selections, you'll have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. You're in total control, and you only pay for the clothes you keep. Plus, you have the option of receiving clothes once every 1, 2, or 3 months because Bombfell is on your side, and they don't make money if you don't find something you want to keep. I just got my first order from Bombfell. I gave my stylist my measurements and answered just a few questions about my style and what I like. He came back to me with a hand-picked outfit just for me. My stylist selected a beautiful sports jacket made out of high-quality linen, perfect for the summer, along with a button-down and a polo shirt that go great with my new jacket or on their own. I was able to change the color if I want, and if I'm ever not in love with the selection, I just say so and my stylist comes back to me with a totally new selection. And these weren't some weird off-brand items. We're talking quality, fashionable clothes that fits great. Plus, it was easy and fast, and I didn't have to waste a lot of time in a store. I love good clothes, and that's why I really love Bombfell. Best of all, I've negotiated with Bombfell to get my listeners a special offer of $25 off your first purchase when you go to bombfell.com/kick. That's Bombfell, spelled bombfell.com/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast. Well, as part of your gradual political evolution after that, you struck up a close friendship with your predecessor, the late Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone. What did you learn from him, and what did you admire about Paul Wellstone?
Well, I don't want to exaggerate my friendship with Paul. Mm-hmm. We were friends, but there were hundreds of thousands of people in Minnesota.
Yeah, he was very well liked. That's for sure.
Yeah, and what I liked about him was his passion. Was his and his compassion, and he really worked for the little guy. He championed mental health. His brother, I think, had been, if I recall, schizophrenic, and he worked with Pete Domenici on mental health and mm-hmm. addiction parity, treatment for addiction, and. He was amazing. Amazing speaker, could rally people. And he, in 2002, right before he died in a plane crash about 11 days before the election.
Right.
With his wife, with his daughter, with three aides and two pilots. And that was a huge...
Yeah.
Crushing blow to Minnesotans mm-hmm. and especially to Democrats in Minnesota, to DFLers.
And I remember the memorial service. That was all over the media, and Republicans tried to make political hay out of that.
Yeah, and I wrote about that. There's a chapter in Lies and Lying Liars who tell them a fair and balanced look at the right about that and how it was really used by Republicans and by the mm-hmm. right. And successfully, and Norm Coleman won because of actually the way it was portrayed, and kind of what got me involved in, or what got me interested in actually running, was a few months after he got into office, Norm Coleman did a interview, a profile with Roll Call magazine, and in it he said, "I'm a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone," and. That did not sit well with me, and that was the first I read that, and I said, I wonder who's going to beat this guy,
mm-hmm.
except I didn't say guy, but, and...
Did you think it might be you?
Yeah, it was the first time I ever considered running for office, and that's a really bad reason to run for office, is that you don't like a guy, but... it became more and more about improving people's lives, which is what Paul... said politics was about. He says it's not about winning for the sake of winning. It's not about power. It's not about money. It's about working to improve people's lives. Mm-hmm. And it became very apparent. I started doing a radio show on Air America, moved the radio show out to Minnesota, and then I started going around the state doing bean feeds, which is sort of the organizing principle of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And I had had Elizabeth Warren on the show, who talked about that 50% of bankruptcies are caused by a health crisis. But when I went around Minnesota and heard from people and would go to a cafe or a VFW and saw flyers for, you know, a spaghetti dinner or burger bash for a family that had gone bankrupt because of a health crisis, for wow. someone got cancer, that's when it became personal, because it's personal to the people of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And so it became personal to me. And that's why right now one of the things I'm so focused on is defeating this this bill in the Senate, which is a terrible, terrible bill, which is basically taking health care away from people who need it the most, and in order to give a tax cut to people who need it the least.
Yeah, you're a little bit of a soothsayer in this book, because you actually predict in the book that by the time it's published, the GOP may have succeeded in repealing Obamacare, but they won't have replaced it yet. They haven't gotten it through the Senate yet, but well, of course Trump is now saying, well, let's repeal and then we'll get around to replace.
Yeah, he's reversed himself on that, and I don't think they're going to do that. But I was saying, they have not shown any real willingness to work substantively on health care. And the ideas in this one are really terrible, and it's very bad. I'm the co-chair of the Rural Health Caucus in the Senate, and I go around Minnesota to hospitals and nursing homes and clinics, and they hate this. They hate this. Mm-hmm. They hated the House bill. This has the bill in the Senate has 17% approval, and that's the exact number of Americans who have said they've seen a ghost. And I think there's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, maybe. And it must be personal to you also, because two of your biggest issues are addiction. You've had people in your life who've been touched with addiction.
Mental
health in general, yeah. From your carrying the torch for Paul Wellstone on that as well.
Yeah,
and those are two of the areas legacy. Where people could slip through the cracks, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we have an opioid epidemic right now. Mm-hmm. And if you... A lot of Americans are getting treatment through Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And if you cut those people off Medicaid, they won't be able to get that treatment. So that's a really bad idea. I had my partner, Tom Davis, the late Tom Davis, he died a few years ago of cancer, not of addiction. But he never really got clean. And my wife... is a recovering alcoholic, and she did an ad for me. You know, the dehumorizer and the whole their whole campaign was really going after me. Yeah. My wife said, "This is not you, and I'm not going to stand for this." And she did a beautiful ad about having, you know, being alcoholic, and she said in it, she said, "How could a mother of two such beautiful kids be an alcoholic," which really spoke. It just hit that note of the shame.
Yeah.
And the 2 days after that ad aired, she got a standing ovation at a debate we were having in a gymnasium, which was a lot of people in it, and she got a standing ovation. Wow. Because she did an ad that actually... a political ad that may have helped people, because there might have been some people who saw that who said, mm-hmm. think I maybe should get into a rehab. And but she talked about, I had written a couple movies. I co-wrote a movie called When a Man Loves a Woman with Ron Bass about alcoholism and the family, the codependency aspect of that. And then I had that character Stuart Smalley, which was about that. And I did a movie with Harold Ramis directed it. It was his least successful movie ever, but it's still played at rehabs and in family programs and stuff like that. And so I'm very proud of both movies. And so she said that she made an ad sort of vouching for my character.
Yeah, and one of the most touching stories that I read in here was you talk about your friendship with Chris Farley and how you created this sketch, the rehab guy, which I can
still remember.
And it sounds like that hit pretty close to home, but apparently Chris actually loved doing that
one. He loved it, and that's dark humor for you. You know, it was we were doing a sketch about a guy who couldn't, who just kept relapsing, who couldn't get it, couldn't find recovery, and it was performed by a guy who kept relapsing, and he loved it. He just, how about another relapse guy? And I think we only did one, but he kept asking for it. And, you know, that was very sad. You know, in the first incarnation of the show, the first 5 years, we really didn't think about, you know, this can kill you. And Belushi just sort of proved that to everybody. And by the time Farley came around, everybody knew, and he must have gone to 12 rehabs or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just couldn't stick.
Well, when you first ran for election, you say that Obama didn't help you terribly much. He didn't really want to be seen in a picture with you.
Well, you know, in fairness to him,
he
did not really campaign with a lot of other candidates because I think he was kind of trying to not be partisan.
Right.
But toward the end there, I was, everyone knew our race was incredibly close, and he could have just landed at the Rochester airport and done a little photo op with me, and it wouldn't have hurt him anywhere. But, you know, after this last election, I just, you know, the job of the head of the ticket is to win.
Right.
I think we've got that now. So I don't fault him at all for just running the whole through the finish line.
Yeah.
And but after the finish line, when I was in my recount and then the legal battle, I could have used him to do a fundraiser for me, which they said they would do, and they didn't.
And it was also kind of a slow courtship that you had to go through with Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer, who was then the head of the Democratic National Senatorial Campaign
Committee.
Yeah, that
was the early part of my campaign.
Right.
Well,
how did you eventually win them over?
I won them over by winning over the DFLers in my state, by winning our party over. But, no, I had known Chuck. He went to, I think he was a year ahead of me in college. So he had, and also I lived in New York doing Saturday Night Live. So I would, you know, he was a Democratic politician there. I was a Democrat and I'd cross paths with him. But he was basically very honest with me. He said, we should be able to win this. We should have a 60% chance of beating Norm. And I think you have about a 40% chance. And I, you know, and he was right. He just completely predicted they're going to run ads using, you know, taking everything you said out of context. And he was right about that. And I think it was partly that I was the reason I won the endorsement of Democrats in our convention, which is the way it's usually done in Minnesota, is that the Democrats in Minnesota wanted me.
Well, you did finally win, but then you had to go through a 6-month recount. You didn't get seated until July,
like a
right?
2-month recount.
Okay, and then a legal battle.
Then 6 months of a legal battle. Norm Coleman, who I beat, and don't worry about him. He's landed on his feet in case people are worried about him. He now serves the state of Minnesota as a paid lobbyist for Saudi Arabia, so he's fine. Don't worry about Norm. The morning after the election, Norm was ahead by, I think, 725 votes. And he said, if I were Franken, I'd step back and let the healing begin. And then we had the recount. In Minnesota, you count all the ballots. It's not, they're hand counted. It's not Florida. And we went through all the ballots, and they're all just, you just fill in a circle. Mm-hmm. And people do it wrong. So, I ended up winning by 312 votes on the recount, in time to be seated with the rest of my class, by the way. And that's when Norm took the anti-healing position. And then he stuck with it for another 6 months as we went through different court battles.
Well, when you finally made it into the Senate, what were some of the ground rules that your staff laid down for you as a new senator?
Well, it was sort of, you know, we laid them down together. Mm-hmm. It occurred to my chief of staff, Drew Lipman, that I faced kind of parallel challenges to Hillary Clinton when she had come to the Senate, and she had been a very effective senator. She had some celebrity, so the Democrats were probably a little afraid that she might take some of their camera time and their and the Republicans probably were suspicious of her because she had been the wife of a president who had been impeached. And so we went to visit Tamara Lozado, who had been her chief of staff in the Senate, and she just said, be a workhorse, not a show horse, and go to all your hearings and come prepared, come early, stay late, mm-hmm. and show your colleagues you're there to work. And I knew also not to be funny.
Yeah. But in the office, right?
Except I could be funny staff. In the office. I could be funny on the floor with my colleagues, just not publicly funny. Yeah. So my colleagues, they got it right away. The Republicans, who I had used my humor to heap scorn and ridicule upon for years, got it right away. Jim DeMint is a very, very conservative senator from South Carolina at the time, went on to head the Heritage Foundation, came up to me like a minute after I was sworn in and said, how are things on the far left? And I said, they're great. How are things on the nutcase right? And he laughed and I laughed and we're friends, you know, mainly giving each other crap throughout as long as he was there, and he left. And, you know, I have a lot of friends on the Republican side, and a lot of them are very funny.
That surprised me that you list a number of Republicans that you get along well with.
Yeah.
In particular, you seem to have a running shtick with Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas. Yes.
Well, Pat right. Roberts is a big Jack Benny fan, and also a big Bob and Ray fan. But Bob and Ray were these radio
right,
comics.
I remember,
so you probably know because you're in... But also Jim Benny, I think more people are obviously familiar with Jack Benny, and Jack Benny had these cast of characters on his TV show and on his radio show, mm-hmm. and there was a character actor named Frank Nelson.
Yeah,
and Benny would go up to the train station to the ticket office and, may I help you?
Was he the one who goes, again. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I loved that. Yeah.
You again. May I help you? And then it was just, Benny had this cast of character actors. And so whenever I see.
You guys should take it on the road.
Well, no one knows what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
so
true.
I just see. I just see Pat and I go, may I help you? And everyone's going, what the hell are they? Why are they having so much fun? Pat and I work together.
Yeah. And on the other hand, you describe Senator Ted Cruz as a toxic coworker. What do you mean by that?
Well, he doesn't. There are 100 of us in the Senate. And so it's a workplace. And each one of your senators is a coworker. And you really... to get things done, have to get along with each other. And I write a chapter about Ted that's kind of he's like the exception to the rule. And he's like a toxic coworker. He's like the guy who microwaves fish, you know, for lunch at the office. He's just not and your word has to be good. I write at the beginning of the chapter I say this is, you know, what you should understand about Ted Cruz is that I like Ted Cruz probably more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. And then I don't have enough time, I don't think, to tell But it's in the book. Get the book. Al Franken, yeah. Giant of the Senate.
I have to bring up Sessions then. One of the most memorable exchanges you had was with Jeff Sessions during his confirmation hearing for Attorney General. Here's a guy that you had gotten to know personally. Your wives hung out. You say that his wife even knitted a blanket for your grandchild.
Yeah.
Suddenly, here he is lying under oath, you know, saying that he had no contact with the Russians, being, frankly, kind of a little weasel. Were you like, who is this guy suddenly?
Well, I knew who he was politically in terms of, you know, what he stands for. I liked Jeff. We had, but I
notice you're using the past tense, by the way.
Well, I think that we're, our friendship has been strained by the confirmation process. And I asked him a question where I basically asked him, if it turns out that members of the Trump campaign had ties, you know, continuous ties with the Russians during the campaign, what would you do? Meaning, would you recuse yourself? And he said, well, I didn't have any communications with the Russians, and that turned out not to be true.
Right.
Now,
the Russian ambassador.
Yeah.
That's a Russian, right?
The Russian ambassador, Kislyak, is Russian.
He counts.
He counts. Okay. And he met with him at least twice that we know of.
Not a guy who's easy to forget either.
No, he looks like the Russian ambassador, very much so. Yeah. If you're from the Khrushchev era, he has that kind of feel. And then since then, he has, the way he's responded to that has not, I've not appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to come back before the committee. He's the attorney general. He's the head of the Justice Department, and we're the Judiciary Committee. He needs to come back and talk to us, and I want to talk to him about that exchange, because he has characterized it very differently than what the exchange really was. Yeah. And that was not necessary. And yeah. Also, he's just terrible on criminal justice. He's terrible on immigration. He's terrible on civil rights. Yeah.
Well, before we go, I have to say, whenever I think of being a politician, the one thing that's least attractive about it to me is the idea of having to go to every cocktail reception and listen to every guy willing to write a $1,000 check tell you how to do your job. I'm so glad to finally see someone in the Senate be honest about the misery and drudgery of fundraising. And you say that you even make a song out of it when you have to do donor calls.
Well, that's
could
fine,
you
yeah.
give us the song before we
yeah,
go?
Yeah, that's good. Someone finally asked me that for audio. What I do is I have a thing called Call Time the Musical. And Call Time is when you call people for money. Basically. And so you usually just, you call people have a lot of money. And very often you don't get them and you leave a message. And so I have a song for that. That's the song you hear the most during Call Time the Musical, which is, I left a message. Oh, yes, I did. I left a message. I do not kid. No. I left a message on the phone. I left a message. He was not home, 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 home. And there's different versions of it. And in my mind's eye, there's a chorus.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it's it has guys on stilts. And
dog
acrobats and chimpanzees.
Okay.
On tricycles. He left a message. Oh, yes, he did. Yeah, you know. And someday okay. we're going to mount Call Time the Musical
okay.
while I do Call Time.
Well, I can't wait to
get
see
a
it.
Theater in Washington. Or maybe we'll just take it to Broadway, okay. but that might be post my Senate career.
Any thoughts of 2020?
We're going to, you know, have a lively process, I think, and get a great candidate, and it ain't going to be me.
Okay. Well, again, the book is called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Senator Al Franken, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Senator Al Franken for joining me on the podcast. Order Al Franken, Giant of the Senate on Amazon.
or download the audiobook for free with a special promotion just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Keep up with him at franken.senate.gov and follow him on Twitter at Al Franken. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.